Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The Gun Violence Archive has reported more mass shootings in the United States than days so far this year. There's been a total of 255. Every day, 100 Americans are killed with guns, and hundreds more are shot and injured, according to Everytown for Gun Safety. As so many in the media continue to play Donald Trump's talking points from the NRA, we want to put a few facts out there. The NRA spent $30 million to elect Donald Trump. According to CNBC, the NRA spent $1.6 million during the first half of this year lobbying Congress against laws that would enact stricter background checks. The NRA also lobbies against assault weapons bans. But the evidence is very clear. According to the Giffords Law Center, states with stronger gun laws have lower gun death rates year after year. But until we have federal laws, we will continue to have people like the Gilroy Garlic Festival shooter buy assault rifles in neighboring states like Nevada because they are illegal here in California. So on today's Your Call, we are going to find out how communities in Gilroy, California, Dayton, Ohio, and El Paso, Texas are coping in the aftermath of these horrific tragedies. We will be joined throughout the show by three reporters there. Joining us now is Kate Simony. She's a reporter for the Salinas Californian. Hi, Kate. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Kate. I understand that you have recently been talking to families, especially Latino families in the area, and they have told you that never before have they been so frightened of white supremacy. Can you tell us about some of the conversations you've been having with families and people in the area?
Sure. Well, I recently attended a birthday celebration for Kayla Salazar, the 13-year-old who was gunned down last week. She was killed exactly 1 week before her 14th birthday. And so her family members essentially held a little send-off for her this past Sunday in a park in San Jose, and they showcased her artwork. They, you know, had food. They had a mariachi band come, which actually played some traditional songs of mourning, like Rocío Dúrcal's Amor Eterno. And, you know, when I spoke with family members, they said that some of them were even frightened to gather in that park just because they don't feel safe anywhere, particularly leaving their home. I know some other shooting survivors have said that they are currently too anxious to leave their homes. They feel nervous when they're going to the grocery store, even. They don't want to be looked at by people. You know, I think this is going to reverberate for quite a while for them.
Wow. I read the piece that you wrote about Kayla Salazar and her memorial. And in your piece, you quoted her aunt. Is it Katiuska Pimentel?
Yes.
And she said that she believed the Latino community and people of color as a whole are at risk of target of white supremacists. She said, "We live in a system where people of color are marginalized in many ways. The fact that we're seeing this type of violence is not a surprise to me." She said, "I'm always fighting for justice, and this time I just think that I need to heal, and then I will fight for justice. But it's just really difficult." I think this is really important to focus on, just the fact that so many people in the Latino community, I mean, they've already been the brunt of these racist comments from Trump and right-wing media. I mean, that's how he started his campaign. But now, I can't even imagine, not only did they have to, you know, lose their cousin in this case, but then when you look at what happened in El Paso, and we're going to talk about that later, I mean, that shooter was specifically looking for Latinos to kill.
That is something that that they mentioned to me, and you know, we do know currently that the Gilroy shooter is not at the moment definitively connected to a white supremacist motive, although he did feature, or rather an Instagram account believing to be his, featured a photo of a book on white supremacy on it shortly before he committed suicide. And the other I think fact on the flip side of that is that the three people who were killed at the Gilroy Festival were all people of color. But again, the FBI has said that they can't connect him to the white supremacy as a motive yet. So I know the El Paso shooting was very upsetting to a lot of these family members, and they felt that it really only reinforced the white supremacy connection to these mass shootings for them. And they absolutely were very upset by those.
Kayla Salazar was shot and killed, 13 years old. We also have Trevor Irby, 25, and Stephen Romero, just 6 years old. Have you been able to talk to any of their family members, or can you tell us anything about them?
We actually haven't connected with the Romero and Irby families yet. We have been reaching out, though.
You know, the other thing that you brought out in some of your pieces, Kate, that I think is so important and really deserves so much attention. From another piece, you write about Gabriella Gauss and Bryn Ota Matthews, who were inside a bounce house at the Gilroy Garlic Festival when the shooting began. You write, barefoot and without their cell phones or any ID, they found themselves sprinting for the parking lot after they saw the gunmen from the bounce house stairs. The two shooting survivors spoke Thursday to reporters about the moment the gunman opened fire inside the fairgrounds. And Ota Matthews, who's 26, and Gauss is 23, said that their thoughts are consumed by the shooting. They said that it's just really intense, having to describe sudden moments. Gauss said, "There isn't a moment I've been awake that I haven't thought about this." And she was grazed on her back and shot through her right shoulder. She's going to have bullet fragments inside of her body for the rest of her life. Ota Matthews was shot in the back. The bullet grazed her lung. So this is just a story of two people who were also shot. Can you talk about what really struck you about them? I mean, Ota Matthews said, "I'm going to have a bullet in my liver for my whole life." And if I remember correctly, they do not have health care. There have been GoFundMe campaigns launched for them, right?
Yes, those two women work at a Bantam Restaurant in Santa Cruz, neither of them had health insurance, and their mothers, I believe it was their mothers, opened GoFundMes for them to raise money, not just for their current treatment, but for treatment that they'll continue to receive. They had an incredible story. They went through something that, you know, they I think rightfully said was really frightening. If I remember correctly, they were climbing the stairs of the bounce house to the slide, and they just threw their bodies down the stairs, literally just pitched themselves down. And once they hit the parking lot is actually when they were shot. And they got a ride in a golf cart, which took them further, and then they ended up in a man's car. Gauss thanked the man. She only remembered his name as being John, but he and his 6-year-old son drove them to the hospital. And I remember as Gauss was talking to reporters, she just was shaking sometimes. She had a lot of I think it seemed like a lot of nerves, but they were both very eager to speak and explain, you know, what the impact was going to be on their lives going forward.
Yeah, and I think it's so important to talk about people who are going to need some kind of health care, physical therapy, a mental health care for many, many years to come. And if they don't have health insurance, what do they do? I mean, in many cases, the families launch these GoFundMe campaigns. Last night, Bernie Sanders was doing a rally in California, and the city name escapes me, so sorry for that. But a young woman got up and she said, "You know, I was in Las Vegas when that horrific shooting happened, and I now have PTSD every time a shooting happens. And unfortunately, they happen so much that think about the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who experience some kind of PTSD." And she said, "I cannot afford to go to therapy. So what do I do?"
It's a really good question. And I think there's a lot of people in Gilroy right now who are trying to figure that out. I know in Gilroy that they've been doing something that a lot of mental health experts have decreed is very important. In the wake of this shooting, they've been holding a lot of community events, a lot of vigils, a lot of fundraisers, community conversations where they can just get together and talk to each other. And this actually was a really big topic at even just the first vigil on Monday, when the mayor got on stage and he talked about how the community needed to come together in order to help itself heal, and help each other heal. And I read some studies while I was researching an article for that that indicated that that really did help people move forward in the long term, that they were able to just, have a stronger base to start from because they had people to lean on.
We're joined by Kate Simony. She's a reporter for the Salinas Californian. And if you have any questions or comments for Kate, we're gonna she's gonna stay with us for the next 5 or so minutes about what happened at the Gilroy Garlic Festival. If you know anyone who was there, we'd love to hear from you. I just feel like, Kate, we've been covering this for years, and you just keep asking the same question. I mean, we know in some ways the answer to this in terms of what federal laws we need, but how do we truly tackle this issue of gun violence? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And I think we need to repeat that the NRA spent $30 million to elect Donald Trump. The talking points that he gave last night are getting a lot of coverage in the media. I am not really hearing that $30 million number, which is really important. Also, the NRA spent $1.6 million during the first half of this year lobbying Congress against laws that would enact stricter background checks. The NRA also lobbies against assault weapons bans. Kate, before we move on and talk about laws and the gun that the shooter used, is there anything else you'd like to talk to us about? We've got 3 people who were shot and killed. Is this number right? 13 were shot and injured?
We're actually double-checking that right now because we've gotten slightly conflicting information on that. So I apologize. It's at least a dozen injured, maybe as many as 16 injured. But we do know 3 people were shot and killed, yes.
Okay. And is there anything else you'd like to tell us before we move on about what you're hearing in the community and what the community needs at this time?
I do know that we've actually gotten a lot of people reaching out to us at the Californian asking how they could help. There were a lot of GoFundMes that popped up in the immediate aftermath. We actually tried to verify all of them, and as of now, only one has responded to us. But the Garlic Festival and the city of Gilroy itself is directing people who would like to donate to the Gilroy Foundation. That is a nonprofit, and the proceeds will be going to the families of the victims and I believe the survivors.
Okay, that's really important information. Thank you for that. So the Gilroy Foundation is accepting monetary contributions if you would like to do that. I want to talk for a minute before we let you go, Kate, about what we know about the shooter. We know that he was 19. He used a semi-automatic and assault rifle. According to reports, the Chronicle had a good piece about this, actually. He bought the assault rifle in Nevada on July 9th, but he broke the law by bringing it into California, where it falls under the state's assault weapons ban. You have to be 21 in California to buy any type of firearm in California. Can you tell us anything else about what we know about the 19-year-old or the gun that he used?
We don't know much more about the gun. It was purchased from a store, I believe, called Mike's Gun Shop or Big Mike's Gun Shop. I'd have to double-check that for you. The Facebook page for that shop actually posted an apology that was signed Mike and basically said that the person who wrote the post never expected this to happen, and that when the shooter went in and purchased the gun from him, because I believe it was purchased online and then picked up in person, that he seemed normal, and they were very sorry. I know that in the hours preceding the event, the shooter visited several big box stores, although we don't know what he purchased. And then once he made it to the Garlic Festival, he cut a hole in the fence and went in and just began to shoot.
The Chronicle also reports that if the 19-year-old shooter, a Gilroy native who stayed with relatives in Nevada, was actually a California resident, the gun shop where he bought the rifle on July 9th should have shipped the rifle to a licensed dealer in California who would have disallowed the sale under state law. I mean, this is not a question you can answer, Kate, but I would love to know, what are these gun sellers thinking when a young man walks in and buys an automatic rifle?
That's a great question, that is the statement that you read previously is a little tricky at the moment because we do not know if the shooter was living in Nevada or if he was living in Gilroy at the time. You know, we know he grew up in Gilroy and had a family house in Gilroy. That is the one that was searched by the FBI and police, and they'll actually be holding another press conference later today in about 45 minutes to talk about any further findings they've come up with. But we don't know if he was living in Nevada or California and if the Nevada gun shop owner did follow that law.
Well, Kate, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is Kate Simony. She is a reporter with the Salinas, Californian, joining us to talk about how the community in the Gilroy area is coping after the horrific tragedy at the Gilroy Garlic Festival. And as Kate said, so many of the Latinos in the community say that they have never before been so afraid by white supremacy. According to reports, investigators believe Kate actually talked about the manifesto and some of the information we learned about the 19-year-old killer in Gilroy. Now we're going to go to Ohio, and we are joined by Jesse Balmert, a state government reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. Hi, Jesse. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So your mayor, the Dayton mayor, I should say, Nan Whaley, just spoke and said that Donald Trump's rhetoric has been painful for many in our community when asked about the visit tomorrow. Can you tell us what else you heard from the mayor?
You know, I was with the governor who was proposing a few gun restrictions and mental health reforms at the time, but the mayor has consistently said that she, you know, is looking out for the community. I think her concerns about Trump's rhetoric were mostly, there was an instance where he accidentally said the city of Toledo instead of Dayton when he was referring to the shooting in that area. So that was a problem, obviously, but I think he is coming to the area tomorrow to speak about the deaths there.
Well, we wanted to do this show really to focus on the communities that have been so affected by this violence. Right now, Kate, is the latest number that we have, the shooting left 10 dead, including the shooter?
Yeah, so there were 10 dead, including the shooter. There are about 27 people who are injured from this.
And what are you hearing? What really stands out for you in the interviews you're doing with people who've been affected by this?
Well, I think like in so many of these instances, people are just shocked that this happens in their community. This Oregon district is an area where it's like an entertainment district. There are a lot of bars and places for people to go. It's a place where, you know, individuals feel like they can be safe and have a good time and just be able to go out into their community. And so to have it happen in a place where they felt like they could just be safe is obviously disturbing for people there. The mayor and the governor had a vigil on Sunday night after this had happened, and the governor was addressing the crowd, and there were people who were there for the vigil who were mourning, who really started to scream, you know, do something. So I think there is a fair amount of anger that, you know, they don't feel like things have been fixed in state laws or state policies that would stop something like this.
Right, and do something got a lot of attention in the media. Can we talk a little bit about, since you brought up the governor, so this is Governor DeWine, and this is a Republican who took office in January. He's expected to propose a, quote, red flag law. These types of laws allow police and relatives to ask a judge to remove guns temporarily from individuals whom they fear will cause harm to themselves. The judge grants what's called an emergency risk protection order. What else is this governor planning to do?
Yeah, so this morning, Governor DeWine spoke about that proposal. Another proposal he had would be to require background checks on most gun sales, which would eliminate some of these so-called gun show loopholes. He would allow for the private sale between, you know, certain people, but really cut back on a lot of the background checklist sales that happen in Ohio. So that's another thing. He talked about increasing penalties for people who purchase guns for someone who they know isn't permitted to have it. It's sometimes called a straw man purchase. And just in general, increasing penalties on people who are already convicted of felonies from using guns in future crimes.
And you report that over the past 7 months, lawmakers, mostly Democrats, have introduced bills to curb access to guns through raising the minimum age to purchase firearms. But only one of those bills has received a single hearing, a proposal with a suburban Republican co-sponsor.
Correct. Ohio's legislature is controlled in both the Senate and the House by Republicans, and they've been much more interested in expanding access to guns than restricting any sort of access to guns in recent history. It's the first seven months of this year, Democrats have proposed a number of things that they've proposed previously as well that have just gotten very little attention. So I think that's some frustration from Democrats here at the state capitol is some of the things that the Governor DeWine proposed this morning, they've been trying to get addressed for quite some time with little success. So we'll see if support from the governor and a push from him makes a difference.
Can we talk a little bit about the victims of this shooting? Again, 10 people, including the shooter. And I just want to read a couple names here. Lois Oglesby, 27, a mom of two. Megan Betts, 22, Wright State University student and sister of the suspected shooter. The shooter was 24. Do we have any more information, Jesse, about why he shot and killed his sister?
You know, the police haven't really released anything on motive, and because he's dead, I'm not sure if we will ever know. This wasn't a situation where anyone was particularly targeted because of their race, which has been the case in other parts of the country, because really it was all over the map as far as age and race and so forth. Again, you don't want to speculate. You got to assume that the fact that the sister was there was at least a factor in why it happened there.
So his sister, again, was shot and killed. Megan Betts, 22. Nicholas Coomer, 25, a graduate student. Logan Turner, 30, a machinist. Thomas McNichols, 25, father of four. Derek Fudge, 57, a family man. Monica Brickhouse, 39. Saheed Saleh, 39. Beatrice Warren Curtis, 36. I was watching a very disturbing video last night about the shooter who basically shot in one place. And if you can describe to us what happened, it was just really hard to watch. He shot people in one place. They ran out going into another bar thinking that they would be safe. And you actually see video of him following them into the bar. But there were two officers, plainclothes officers nearby, who shot him within 30 seconds. Can you describe what exactly happened that night?
Well, yeah, like you said, Dayton police were able to respond very quickly within 30 seconds. And so really he was, I think that kind of quick response was something that people really pointed to, that this could have been so much worse. There were lines of people out there, and just really, had they not been so quick, it could have been much worse. Not that it's not already horrible already. So I think just the speed that police were able to respond was something that people kept noting.
And it's also really important, and we'll talk about this maybe on Thursday's show, just about how powerful these guns are. The New York Times reports that the 24-year-old shooter in Dayton purchased his AR-15-style rifle legally online from Texas and had it shipped to a gun store in or near Dayton, according to the police. And they said that it was modified with a pistol brace to improve stability. So I don't know about the laws. I'd love to learn more, that you can buy a rifle legally online from Texas and have it shipped to then a gun store in Dayton. He had a drum magazine that could hold 100 rounds and enough magazines to hold up to 250 rounds of ammunition. He fired at least 41 shots, according to police. Six officers filed 65 rounds at the gunman. and killed him when he tried to enter the bar we were talking about. So is this getting much attention in Ohio, Kate? Just the power that these assault rifles now have to kill so many people in so little time.
Yeah, we actually asked the governor about this morning, whether, modifications like this pistol brace that was a part of this firearm were something that they were going to look at, and it's not something that they're looking at right now. It'll be interesting whether that enters the discussion, like bump stocks were so much so. But yeah, he was able to purchase this firearm online and from Texas. There was nothing on the man's record that would have prevented him from purchasing a firearm. He had just a few traffic violations, so nothing that would have stopped him under either state or federal law from purchasing a gun. And it was legal to own 100 round drum magazines. So I guess one can ask the question whether it's a good idea to allow all of this, but current law does.
I mean, it's amazing to think that the last time the federal government limited gun ownership was 25 years ago. And, I mean, this was sweeping gun legislation. House Republicans joined Democrats in favor of measures. And so now, I mean, this happened. Bill Clinton was president in 1994, the federal assault weapons ban. And I'm reading from courts right now. Written into the legislation was an expiration date of 10 years. But for that decade, the law essentially banned the manufacture, sale, and possession of military-style assault weapons, including the AR-15. And a study found that the ban reduced the number of mass shootings during the decade it exists. It expired in 2004. Barack Obama tried to renew the ban in 2013 after the Sandy Hook tragedy, but the Senate stood in the way. They voted not to renew it. And so here we are with these young guys being able to buy these semi-automatics that kill so many people in such a short amount of time. And Jesse, before you joined us, we were talking to Kate Cimini about the Gilroy Garlic Festival shooting. Now, these weapons are banned in California, but that shooter was able to go to Nevada, buy the gun, and then bring it to California. And that's why federal laws are needed.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to make a judgment call on federal laws, but I do, that is one thing that comes up often in Ohio when people say, you know, should we try to ban these types of guns? Well, people say, well, you could just go across the border to Pennsylvania or Kentucky or another state and purchase them there. So if it is a patchwork type system, there are easy places to exploit that.
And before we let you go, Jesse, is there anything else you'd like to share with us about just the community, what you're hearing from people who were affected by this tragedy?
Well, I think the Dayton area has been very resilient. They've had a rough year. There was storms that really demolished and devastated the community earlier this year. They had a rally and so forth that was really hard for the community, and now this. So they are dealing with a lot in Dayton, but they're a strong community and really trying to overcome this and make changes so something like this doesn't happen in another community.
Well, Jesse, thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Jesse Belmert is a state government reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. And on today's Your Call, we are checking in with journalists. We just spoke with Kate Cimini, talking about the horrific shooting at the Gilroy Garlic Festival. And then we wanted to talk about what happened in Dayton, Ohio. And coming up after a break, we will speak with Julian Aguilar, no relation. He's a reporter with the Texas Tribune, and he'll be joining us from El Paso, Texas. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue our coverage of gun violence by speaking with Bay Area youth about how they are affected by gun violence in their communities. We'll speak with youth and mentors from Youth Alive and United Playas. They say that urban youth have the power to stop the violence plaguing their communities. So we'll talk with them tomorrow. And if you have a show idea, a guest idea, or feedback for us, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's show, we're talking about the recent mass shootings in the U.S. If you have anything on your mind you'd like to share with us, I mean, it's just a question we keep asking. How do we deal with this epidemic of gun violence? Today, we wanted to speak with reporters in communities that have been affected to talk about what they're hearing on the ground. You can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Joining us now is Julian Aguilar, no relation, who is a reporter with the Texas Tribune. Hi, Julian. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us. Can we first start off, before we talk about the shooter, let's talk about the community in El Paso. We spoke with Kate Simony, a reporter for the Salinas Californian, about how the community in Gilroy is dealing with this. And so many people in that community are Latino. And she said that they've never been so afraid of white supremacy. What are you hearing from the community in El Paso, especially the Latinx community?
Similar statements. I think people are still digesting everything. Obviously, people are very sad about what happened. But, I mean, I think folks have to understand. I mean, I'm not just based in El Paso and cover the border. I'm from here, and this community feels that it's been kicked in the teeth a lot lately. Mm-hmm. We've been painted as a dangerous area, as a war zone by certain lawmakers, because we are on the border, when the exact opposite is what's fact. We are ground zero on the immigration debate. We have people in Ciudad Juarez who are our family members. We, as journalists, we cover the politics and the heartache that goes along with separated families, immigrant families, with migrant deaths, with the toll it takes on law enforcement, Border Patrol, who are also our sisters and brothers. And we all of a sudden wake up on a Saturday morning, and some of us are alive because we decided not to go to Walmart that morning. Mm.
Well, let's talk about the shooter. I mean, ABC News had a piece last night that was really hard to watch because one woman was holding on to her mom. They were having coffee in the Walmart and they were hiding under a table, and she was actually filming what was going on around her. And according to ABC and other news outlets, the shooter allegedly cased this Walmart before shooting. Can you tell us what we know about this? I mean, this is a young man who drove, is it about 500 miles from Dallas?
It's a little bit more than 600. It might be closer to 650. But yeah, I mean, El Paso is the far western edge of Texas. We're in a different time zone, for crying out loud. We have mountains where everybody else has, you know, humidity and the Gulf Coast. I mean, Dallas is in North Texas. You know, I mean, it's not a straight shot at all. So, you know, to a lot of us, you know, if he just wanted to allegedly get in the car and pick off a bunch of Hispanic people, he could have done a straight shot to 35, or he could have gone to other places. But the fact that he drove so far out means that, you know, he targeted El Paso for one reason or another. This Walmart location, there's been some reports that it was chosen at random. I think people are disputing that, because this location is in it's an area that's well known to cater to shoppers from Texas and Mexico. I mean, as far as we know so far, there were 8 of the confirmed fatalities are Mexican nationals from four different states in Mexico. So, it's just like any other huge sprawling shopping complex in the United States. There's a Sam's across the parking lot. There's a Hooters nearby, and then you have a bus depot, and then you have this Walmart, and then a couple blocks to the north of this complex is a high school I went to, and neighborhoods. So it doesn't make any sense that, you know, he just randomly picked a store. That could be the case. Again, you know, I don't want to just overstep what I've heard from the authorities, and they're being careful with the information that they're offering us for great reason, of course. But there's no way to really describe why it should be a Walmart. You know, why do people have to hide under a table at Walmart? Why do people go to a country western show in Las Vegas and have to dodge bullets there? Why do kids go to school and their parents have to get a call that there's been a horrible tragedy? It's just like you said earlier. What are we going to be, you know, how do you deal with this when it happens so often? What are we going to be talking about 2 weeks from now?
No, exactly. And I feel like people are so desensitized that in many cases, after a couple of days, it just goes away.
I think so. You know, I mean, it was, as reporters, it's sort of really, really an odd situation to be from here and to be so close to that community, but to also report on it because, you know, talking to folks from town, from out of town, everybody is trying to figure out what the next angle is, what the next story is, how long they're going to stay. And professionally, you know, we understand that. We understand that, you know, that people need their privacy and their respect. We understand that maybe this story, like others, is going to fade. And then the folks that are from here take off the reporter hat and they're like, well, wait a minute, what the hell's happening? Why are you guys leaving? My neighborhood just got shot up, you know?
Right. So this is a shooter. He was 21 and, as you said, traveled 600 miles from Allen, Texas, a Dallas suburb, to El Paso. And again, this new report from ABC reports he had been looking for a good place to target and shoot Mexicans. He entered Walmart on Saturday morning to case it out. He saw 3,000 shoppers inside. That sounds like a lot to me, but that's what ABC reported. Armed himself and then came back armed with an assault-style rifle. And according to police, the El Paso police chief said the AK-47-style assault rifle was bought legally. Do you know anything more about this gun and where he got it?
No. That's, I mean, I know as much as you all do with respect to Chief Allen's recent comments yesterday. People were asking, you know, what type of weapon it was. Nobody was surprised to hear that it was a high-powered weapon. And again, in Texas, nobody was surprised to hear that it was purchased legally. But you know, that's another thing that people on the border are wondering, why so much criticism and heat about El Paso before this happened? Because, you know, we're on the border city with Mexico, and Ciudad Juarez is a violent city. It's you know, on the rebound from the horrible drug war of about 10 years ago, but it still has a high rate of homicides. And that's another thing that the Mexican foreign minister was saying when he was here, that the government of Mexico is going to investigate and officially denounce American gun laws, which they've been doing for so long. But again, it's the irony of the situation that people assume because we're on the border, we're dangerous. And you've had several elected officials saying El Paso was one of the safest cities of its size. For any other reason than, you know, this is an immigrant community, this is a proud military community, and we're just safe here. It has nothing to do with the fact that we're on the border. And it took somebody to come from North Texas, from 650 miles away from the border, to eliminate that title of the safest city. And he was able to purchase a firearm legally. And that's going to be at the forefront of the debate. Again, you know, the border is traditionally, in El Paso and other places, is traditionally a Democratic stronghold. I'd say more moderate than other places, but people respect gun rights here. People are hunters in El Paso. People work for law enforcement families. Nobody is 100% anti-gun. We just also don't mind background checks or vetting people or having to go through a few more steps in order to make sure that people don't get hurt when they purchase a firearm.
What can you tell us about the manifesto that this shooter, this 21-year-old shooter, left, where he clearly expressed hatred aimed at immigrants and Latinx people? And, I mean, I read the manifesto, and so much of it echoes Donald Trump's racist language.
I mean, I think authorities and as reporters, you know, I think we still need to be careful to say that law enforcement is still trying to directly link this manifesto. I don't know if that's changed from the last 24 hours, but you're right. I mean, my colleague, Alexa Uda, who covers race and immigration and demographics, she wrote a very powerful story, which was also very personal for her because she's from Laredo, Texas. She's also from a border community. And, yeah, you're right. I mean, he wasn't just targeting Mexican nationals. He was targeting Hispanics. How can a person differentiate between a person that looks like myself, who's a Hispanic male, 41 years old, born and raised in the United States, from a 41-year-old Mexican national that was shopping at Walmart? We look the same, you know, which is, I think, that's even more jarring. And sorry if I'm sort of rambling here. This is all just, you know, just talking about it. Kind of, you know, it's still a little difficult to digest. But, I mean, this manifesto, politicians have said, like you said, that there's a lot of sentiments that were allegedly stated here that echo the president's remarks, which I think is why a lot of people are upset and nervous about the president's planned trip to El Paso. I mean, many of the Democratic representatives from this area are on record saying he should not come here. He needs to give this community time to heal. He needs to have to give law enforcement, who are going to be tied up on his security detail, he needs to let them also work this investigation and let those men and women, first responders, maybe relax for a day or two and try to digest this all themselves as well.
You know, I also want to ask you, Julian, what you think of the media coverage, because, you know, Trump gave this speech last night that was basically filled with NRA talking points, the same things we've heard in the past about video games and mental health. And so the media, as they always do, are just repeating what he said. And, you know, I don't want to spend too much time talking about him, but it is important to note that, you know, he says at his rallies on a regular basis, look at what's marching up. That's an invasion. This is an invasion. And now we're learning about all of these ads that he's running on Facebook, millions of dollars worth of ads, repeating these claims about an invasion on the southern border. And in this manifesto, if it was in fact this this guy's manifesto, he wrote that his views predate Trump. So what about media coverage? And how do you think the media should deal with, you know, what Donald Trump says and when he has to be in front of a camera to make a statement, and actually what he does at these rallies and his ads and all of the other racist sentiments he's made over the years?
I can understand the criticism. And when I say I can understand that it exists, it doesn't mean I agree with it or not. You know, I mean, if somebody is an op-ed writer or a columnist or a person that analyzes things, and he or she has the license, I guess, to be a little bit more opinionated, whereas other reporters, I think, you know, we still try to do traditional journalism and just repeat the facts, repeat what we know instead of editorializing. So I think a lot of folks are caught between the rock and the hard place. But what I think is different, at least in this situation, is that the reports that I've seen have done a good job of, I mean, like you say, you know, quoting the president, quoting Governor Greg Abbott, who, when asked on Texas and what they can do with respect to gun laws, he also played up the mental health angle, which is an important angle. I mean, nobody disputes that. But, you know, so we quote him, and immediately afterwards, we quote somebody, in this case, Congresswoman Escobar, who represents El Paso in Congress, who was, you could see her just shaking her head when the governor was making his remarks. And so I think that's the balance that people are able to provide. If people are upset because we're quoting what they say are Republican talking points, A, that's what these officials are saying, and B, we're also getting people that dispute those and putting those above the fold as well. But you're right with respect to the video games and mental health. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick also talked about video games. You know, to their credit, they did say this was an evil act, it was a horrible act, nobody deserves it. But they do skirt around gun laws and play up video games and mental health. And, you know, I don't play video games. I'm not going to comment on the prevalence of how important or not they are. But again, I will say that mental health is an important issue. We should be talking about that, but we shouldn't only be talking about that.
And we'll talk more about media coverage on Friday's show. We have a couple calls, but before we take those calls, I want to make sure that we do not end the show by talking more about the victims and the communities. Two of the victims, actually, that are getting a lot of attention are Jordan and Andre Anchondo. They were shopping with their two-month-old baby. The baby survived with two broken fingers, likely caused after his mother shielded him with her body. I mean, this is just a horrific, horrific story. Any other stories you'd like to share with us, Julian, either about people who were killed or people who were shot and are now in the hospital?
There was a vigil yesterday out in the far east side of town for a teenager who was there shopping for school supplies. There was confirmed senior citizens, and these are the confirmed fatalities. You know, and it's, again, there's no textbook way to report on the victims, because they're also so different. Those parents, like you said, I mean, which parent wouldn't? Mm. Which parent wouldn't defend their son or daughter from a bully? Which parent wants to make sure that they don't swim in the deep end if they can't swim? I mean, it's just, you know, it's just the parental instinct, and the fact that both of these parents, you know, died doing this. It just speaks to, I think, the instinct and the human nature of how senseless this was, but also the shining light is just the love that was out there for this child. And The grieving is also part of that respect that people have for the victims, even if you didn't know them. And we've heard stories about these elderly people, or even people that were, you know, helping the elderly out of this Walmart when they heard the shots fired, you know, shielding these people, trying to get them out to the exits, and making sure that these folks were covered when they could put themselves in danger. I mean, I heard stories about people that ran into a storage shed or a storage trailer in the back of, you know, in the back by the loading dock, you know, in triple-digit heat, and people were just running for cover. It's just, I mean, it's horrible, and it's unique to what happened in this situation. But when you put it in the grand scheme of things, how many cell phone videos have we seen? I mean, we saw one 14 hours later when people were trying to have a nice evening out in Dayton, Ohio. I mean, it's just, you know, I'm sure there were stories of heroism that are coming out of that city as well.
Right. So. Well, let's take a few calls, and thank you for holding. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. Just a question or a comment. One is, I think using the term shooter, even though it may be somewhat appropriate, is a little bit innocuous. I mean, when people do this, I mean, this is terrorism. That's what they should be called, either murderers or terrorists. So I don't know what kind of language people would use to describe it, but it seems to me that calling them a shooter just doesn't fit the bill. The other thing is, Walmart, I think, is the biggest seller of arms in the United States.
Right.
I don't understand why, and maybe this is happening some places, one, why there isn't security at Walmart, better security at Walmart, and secondly, why there isn't, I don't think a boycott of Walmart's going to do much, but demonstrations at Walmart certainly might do something, or really putting pressure on Walmart to stop selling guns, especially automatic weapons like this guy was able to acquire. So hopefully maybe something like that might produce something, because I think trying to get legislation, you're not going to get anything done at the national level unless people are, you know, get their hands around what's his name, McConnell's throat,
right,
to try and get this done.
Well, thank you, Greg. There are a bunch of stories out today. In fact, the New York Times yesterday, "Dear Walmart CEO, you have the power to curb gun violence. Do it." Lots of calls for Walmart to stop selling guns. Are you hearing anything about that, Julian, in the area?
No, I haven't personally, but I mean, I've seen other reports as well. But I forget one of the recent shootings were, I think it was at Dick's Sporting Goods that stopped selling a certain type of firearms. So I think there is public pressure to do things like this. I think, with respect to the caller's first comment about how to identify this alleged gunman or shooter or terrorist, I just think that's just in-house style. You know, I mean, some people say don't even mention his name, don't even run his mugshot. Other people say you should call him what it is. So,
right.
That's just one of the things, you know, that goes with being a reporter and describing the situation. But I also think with respect to boycotts and to you know, assault weapons bans and to putting pressure on Walmart, that may or may not come. But, I just have to remind folks that we're about 72 hours out from when the first call came in. I think people are still trying to digest and figure it out, deal with the president's visit, and then maybe, you know, in another day or two, then they'll, you know, have clear heads enough to try to, you know, do something else with respect to what happened.
And Julian, can you confirm this either way? There were some reports that undocumented immigrants were afraid to seek help, and so even if they were hurt at the Walmart, they just ran away without seeking help. Do you know if that's true?
I've heard the same thing. I haven't spoken to anybody personally. When we were trying to get details on the number of victims, of people that had been taken to hospitals, the police department did say that they couldn't give an accurate count because they had to consider the fact that some people did leave the scene even though they were injured, or maybe they sought help on their own instead of going to authorities. But again, that's just something the police department said they had to consider, whether or not that actually happened. I wouldn't want to speculate as fact or as fiction. But if it did happen, I will say that it's not uncommon to hear that. I mean, I think we've heard in states that pass immigration related legislation at whatever level it is, we've heard stories about people that are hesitant to go to the hospital, or when you hear about ICE raids that may or may not happen on a given weekend, you hear about people that are afraid to go to school or afraid to, you know, go to certain places. So it is a thread that I've heard out there. Whether it's confirmed or not, I can't speak to that, but it is a common theme regardless of whether it's a shooting or whether it's just any legislation that's out there that scares the immigrant community.
And in El Paso, do you think that this will push people even more into the shadows? What are you hearing about that?
I don't, with respect to immigration, I don't think so. I mean, CBP and DHS, they were very, very quick to put on their Twitter accounts and social media here that they are not doing increased enforcement action, that, you know, they need to help the first responders and, you know, to disregard these fears that were out there. So I think it's just the fact that people in general, regardless of their status, are going to look over the shoulder a little bit more. Again, you know, I mean, what are we checking off the list here of where these things occur? Well, you know, Walmart, elementary schools, churches, concerts. You know, I mean, what's next? It doesn't really, you don't have to pigeonhole somebody's immigration status to assume that they might be a little bit more scared to go out into public places after something like this happened. Mm.
There was also a yoga studio in Florida, which someone reminded me of the other day, which I forgot about. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, I mean, it's happening so often that we forget all the places that it's happening.
Exactly. Well, Julian, thank you for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Julian Aguilar is a reporter with the Texas Tribune, and you can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. Over the next 2 days, we will continue talking about gun violence. Tomorrow, we will speak with Bay Area youth about how they're affected by gun violence. Youth and mentors from Youth Alive and United Playas believes that urban youth have the power to stop the violence plaguing their communities. And then Thursday, we'll talk about gun laws and also what explains so many young men. These are young, 21, 19 years old, who are buying assault rifles and killing people in bars, like Julian said, in so many different places. And it's important to note that in other countries, there are a lot of angry white men, but they don't have easy access to guns. So we're going to talk about that on Thursday. Thanks to Shireen Adel for producing today's show, and thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. You can find more information about the show and listen to past shows at yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up for our podcast there. And if you have any show ideas or any new angles on gun violence or guests that you'd like us to invite on, please email yourcall@kalw.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.